to let it go into the magazine are listed as anonymous.
Are always anonymous, are they not?
Say again, Frank.
I understand it with academic journals. Peer reviewers are anonymous, aren't they, while editors are not? Isn't that how it works?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, yes. In the articles themselves, they don't list the peer review people. But theoretically, if you try and find out who did the peer review, that's usually available. You know, it's not published in the journal itself, but it is available elsewhere.
Okay, so typically in traditional academic journals, the reviewer, the authors know who the peer reviewers are?
That I don't know. Maybe after the fact, I doubt before the fact, but I don't think there is a set rule.
Okay, very good. I'll try to speak to somebody who's knowledgeable on this stuff and come back next week if I hear more than anything. Really not much of a thing. It's either WB2BS stuff.
Okay, very good, Frank. Please tell us what you learn. You know, the problem is way too much published material out there. Part of academia is publish or perish, and so everyone's writing articles. Every so often, someone who wants to demonstrate the absurdity of the system will generate a random string of words that mean absolutely nothing and get them published in a somewhat legitimate journal. And then we'll do a press release of how silly everyone is. So unfortunately, just because it's published in a journal does not necessarily mean that it's good science. A lot of reports and experiments are unfortunately poorly done, poorly assessed. The math is sometimes wrong. You would kind of hope that everything is historic and done perfect, but that's not the nature of many journals. If you stick to the more prestigious ones, there are much tighter gatekeeping that goes on, but even they sometimes have to retract their stories on the basis of dramatic errors in their thought process. Any other comments, questions, or such, please? This is AC2GS. Just give me your first name and your call sign.
Managed to get a paper through peer review that suggested that fast radio bursters, like some of them, could be of intelligent origin. I'm sure you had fun with that one.
Yeah, I mean, there's loads of silly, you know, journal articles. Matter of fact, there's an organization that has a press release around the same time that the Nobel Committee, when they report out the Nobel Prize winners for biology, medicine, physiology, chemistry, physics, and what have you, called the Ig Nobel Awards, where they take some research that seems as silly as heck, and they give it a prize. So there's lots of dubious research papers out there. It's kind of difficult to find too many at the prestigious journals, but if you hunt around, you could always dig up a few real clinkers.
Yeah, a buddy of mine with a doctorate, I think, nicknames them the Journal of Irreproducible Phenomena.
Yeah, I think I heard that some guy put a BS article in that one as well.
Yeah, I haven't looked that up. I'm not 100% sure if that the Journal of Irreproducible Phenomena is a joke or whether there really is one. I mean, somebody told me about that years ago.
Yeah, I mean, there's all kind of combinations. I mean, this is a legitimate journal that I was just mentioning. There are far less legitimate journals. There are journals that simply exist online. They don't even bother to publish or print anything. And sometimes you'll get the screwiest ideas, and you'll get the same guys who are pretty much quacks present really questionable material to these sites, and they seem to have no gatekeepers at all. So there's a lot of different levels of journal out there. There's a place called X, ARIVX or something, which is kind of a mixture of everything. It's a site to upload your paper before a legitimate journal has decided to publish it. So some of their articles are very legitimate, and some are far less legitimate. So, but the world of journals is a curious thing. If you've ever wandered through a library that keeps journals, it takes up so much space. Maybe it's a good idea to reduce it to a computer-based system.
I think what you're talking about are called the preprint servers. There's sometimes some kind of interesting stuff on there. I remember hearing about some report by some Google researchers showing up on a preprint server, proposing a method for accelerating a spacecraft to within a small fraction of the speed of light and without expending propellant. And I know once that paper circulated for a while, apparently that one was pulled. Not surprisingly. Go ahead.
Yeah, like I said before, I mean, some of them are quite legitimate. Sometimes authors are really antsy. They want people to read their stuff as soon as possible, and they're in a deal with a journal that allows for them to put it online temporarily, and then they may modify it and tweak it and adjust it for the final publication, but it's a legitimate paper. And on the other end of the spectrum, you got guys who have a weird sense of humor who are publishing nonsense, or the occasional grifter who is just kind of leaving some kind of a semi-professional trail behind so that, you know, when he goes on a forum board, he can cite his paper and his friend's paper. There's a whole bunch of make-believe papers listed on those things. It's rather unfortunate. I mean, I've read guys' patent explanations for principles that make no particular sense in the laws of physics. But one of the beauties of patents is that since about 1890 or so, you don't have to prove a concept. You don't have to. In the old days, you had to provide an actual working model in order to get approval. Now you could scribble nonsense, and as long as you don't discuss things like perpetual motion or such, and it's not an obvious stolen idea like the paperclip, you pretty much get a patent for it. So figure. Oh well, what can you do?
From what I've heard, it's actually fairly difficult to get a patent through. It's like always rejected the first time, and that kind of generates work for the patent lawyers. working with the inventor and generates work for the patent office itself. At least that's my interpretation. I'm sure there were people who would argue with me, but my impression is the patent always gets rejected the first time and maybe the first few times before it finally goes through with it. It is quite a bit of work to get a patent through. Go ahead.
I think it tends to be the form that the putting the patent through is the arduous one. You have to have it in a certain form and demonstrate some uniformity. To a degree, a lot of these patent offices are scams. If you recall, I don't want to go into politics, but a previous attorney general was a lawyer for a patent firm that had clients who had toilet bowls for, shall we say, very large men.
Yeah, well, you know, it's again another system that's sort of designed to generate work for everybody, apparently. You know, another very interesting swap in Washington and probably other capitals around the world also. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, to a degree, it's all kind of a way of making money. You know, sometimes you see the in court, you see two lawyers, one's on one side, the other's on the other side, and they bump into each other and make a golf date for the weekend. So, you know, it's all a way of getting money in more ways than one, unfortunately. Patents, I have seen enough weird patents that make no particular sense, that you really do not have to have a grasp on reality in order to get an approved patent. You know, you just have to stay away from a bunch of keywords that they're kind of triggered on. But, you know, you could build an anti-gravity device as long as you don't call it an anti-gravity device and just have images of people floating above it. And if you dot the I's and cross the T's, my guess would be it would be approved.
Yeah, what you're saying is if it's correct as to form, as I think the lawyers say, it might fly with patent office, even though it makes no sense. You know, of course. Anyway, all right, enough of that already. We can go around in circles on this forever and, you know, not really say a whole lot, I think. Go ahead, WB2BXO.
Yes, indeed, Frank. If anyone out there has any great ideas to patent, please don't tell me about it. Thanks, Frank. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I appreciate it. I want to remind people that if you have any mailbag questions or you want to share a puzzle or you want to hear about a topic or you want me to poke Paul and ask him to take a look at something space-related, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. My link page with a whole bunch of interesting articles and YouTubes are available at roy.ac2gs.com. And remind you that I stream the repeater 24/7. So if you are away from its site or you don't have a radio, but you do have a browser, you just type in technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the audio stream. And as always, like to remind people that Mike KC2NJI has a great archive of the LimeArc TechNets going as far back as September of 2006, and that's at amateurradio.tv. So please keep that in mind. Thanks again, and now on to Paul with the SpaceNet report.
AC2GSWS to land. Okay. Update on the fireworks. Trying to see if my meter would move on 40 meters. And, you know, the meter moves, but I can't relate it to the fireworks. But it was fun to look at it. You know, I could see stuff going up in the sky right from the window. And of course, I just put 40 meters on, waiting for something. And you know, you see the meter move. You can hear static crashes, but you can't really. I can't relate it to the fireworks. You never know. I didn't see a correlation. Back to you, Roy, before I go on.
Oh well, something to possibly experiment in the future. Locally here, I'm very close to Coney Island, so at least once a week they're shooting stuff into the sky. So maybe I'll look at my pan adapters when that happens.
Really? Oh, okay. When you walk around the streets or any stores or anything, what's the percentage of people you see without masks? I would say we're getting down to probably about 70% of the people no longer have masks out here in Suffolk County.
Yeah, locally it's probably about the same, maybe 10-15%. It's kind of difficult to really count. It sort of depends on which area you go to. There are some areas in Brooklyn where the rate of mask wearing at the peak of COVID was maybe about 10%. So that's the strange areas of Brooklyn. But here it's somewhat unusual. You see 10-15%, I think.
Okay. Now, they did say Staten Island is creeping up. They're up to, in some zip codes, they said 4%. I heard that on CBS radio anyway. But, I guess some areas are going to experience problems. As long as they don't creep, get too high. We got down to... I keep looking at the numbers. At one point, it was 0.2%. And now I see we're up to, 0.4, 0.5. We went up a little bit. I think the other day, we were 0.7. But at least we got away from, 5%, 6%, big numbers like that.
Yeah, my gut feeling is we have gone through the worst of it, I hope. It sort of depends on how much of a reservoir of infectable people and the possibility of a new variant that's worse than Delta. But I think we've gotten through the worst of it. We're probably going to have a smaller echo late fall, early winter, because this is a somewhat seasonable disease, and there's still a good percentage of people who haven't received any vaccination at all in the United States, and I tend to doubt that they're going to.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, I think we did pretty good. It slowed down. I agree. But, if you have more people being hospitalized, I could see that number picking up again, people going in for vaccinations. Especially when they find out the people that are hospitalized are not the ones that were vaccinated, Okay, let me continue on. I have a couple of topics here we'll go through. First of all, does anybody have any comments? This WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Okay. On the 20th of this month, which is the anniversary of landing of the moon, we have a rocket, a New Shepard, that's going to be launched from New Mexico. New Shepard is a suborbital spacecraft and rocket. It's a one-stage rocket, runs on liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, and it's got the one rocket on the bottom, and that accelerates the crew capsule up to just above 100 kilometers, which is just above the common line. The common line is 62 miles high, and that was established because at that level, Theodore Common, he's the one that came up with this, he said that would be the area where it would no longer be possible to have any kind of aerodynamic response for an aircraft. It would have to be astrodynamic. It would have to be a spacecraft with thrusters to maneuver. So that's the common line. And this thing will get above that. And this time it will be carrying passengers for the first time. And you've probably seen this on the news. Jeff Bezos will be going up. He owns the company. Naturally, he owns Amazon, but he owns the company Blue Origin. And he'll be going up. He's got a brother he's going to take up with him, Mike. And also an unknown person who's apparently paid $23 million. Thing. He'll be going up. He or she, we don't know who it's going to be, will also be going up on that same flight. Then he's also picked this lady. Her name is name is Funk, Q-N-K. And first name is Wally. And she was one of the 13 people that NASA picked. Well, not NASA, but, you know, the government picked to train for possible space flight during the Mercury program. Mercury, Gemini, and eventually Apollo. And we had Mercury 7. That was all picked, you know, to go to on the first flight. And then you had the Mercury 13, they call it. It was separate from NASA, but they were training them anyway. They wanted to see, if eventually they would be picked to go into space. But, of course, none of them were out of the 13. And presently, only two are alive, and one of them has macular degeneration. This lady doesn't. Actually, she was the youngest of the bunch. She's now 82 years old. And she's been flying planes for her whole life, training people how to fly planes. Spent her whole life in aviation. So anyway, Jeff Bezos picked her and asked her if she would wanted to fly, and she's elated. Out of all 13, not one of them even, was picked as an astronaut. Even when they started, because it was already starting to get a little late, they wanted people a little younger. When Sally Ride first went up, or eventually Eileen Collins from New York, who eventually commanded a space shuttle flight. These people, we have probably about 40 or so women that have gone up in space in the United States. One of them came from this Mercury 13 group. But Wally Funk did. So now she's going to get a chance to actually get into space. Not orbit, but space. These are suborbital flights. Blue Origin has launched, I think, about 13 or so of these flights, test flights, without people in it. They put a dummy in it. They've set it up, make sure the air conditioning works, make sure the communications work, and it's all going to be autonomous. They'll launch from West Texas, go up 62 miles, or just above that, and then land again in West Texas. The spacecraft does have another rocket on board, for safety in case the problem. It could pull the spacecraft away from the booster. It does have three parachutes, so it's going to come back through the atmosphere And the booster will come also back down to the atmosphere and land vertically. They've done that on a regular basis, quite successful. The B-3 engine reignites a few seconds right before it lands. It lands on a concrete pad that they've laid out. And then eventually the crew vehicle comes back down. And right before it lands, it has these little nitrogen rockets that ignite to soften the blow right before it hits the ground in West Texas. And then they come out with a truck and a van, pick up all four people, Jeff Bezos, his brother, Wally Funk, and whoever this mystery person is that paid $23 million in some kind of an auction to take his first flight. So I guess he's got money to burn. Future people will be signing up probably in the $250,000 to maybe $350,000. But anyway, this happens on the 20th, July 20th, probably around 11 o'clock or so. I'll have to see the exact time. So, you know, it's not the only company that's been trying to launch people into suborbital space. There's one other company, and that's run by Richard Branson. He flies the Unity Spaceship 2, they call it. Again, he's flown many flights to space, test flights with this version. He had an earlier version that actually broke apart in flight, and the pilot was saved, but the co-pilot was killed, and that was back, I think it was 2012 or 13 or so. But since then, he's redeveloped the spaceship, too, to carry up to 8 people. And on this flight, he plans on doing the same thing this month, launching himself to a suborbital flight. Let me drop it. Virgin Galactic. He also owns another company, of course, called Virgin Orbital. Not to be confused, they separated from one another. It's his company, but, you know, it's run differently. Virgin Orbital just recently successfully launched satellites in space into orbit. And they have a system where they put their rocket called Launcher. It's actually called Launcher 1, and they attach it to the wing of a 747 from, you know, an old, 747 that came out of his airplane that he flies. He set it up to be able to carry the Launcher 1. So that recently, last week, successfully put 7 different satellites into orbit at one time. They drop it from the 747, the engine ignites, and off it goes. It also has, you know, it's a liquid fuel rocket, so it has a two-stage system. And that just worked out. So he's on a roll, because now he's also got Virgin Galactic, and he wants to beat Jeff Bezos to space. So next week, before this nap, we'll be talking about this guy, see if he made it. He's headquartered now in New Mexico in a place called Spaceport America. Spaceport America was paid by taxpayers of New Mexico and probably some federal money to have this thing built, and they've been waiting to fly somebody into space for a long time. The pilot and co-pilot have actually done this before. the pilot has done it twice, and the co-pilot has done it once. You know, with testing the Unity to see if this would work. They get carried up to 45,000 feet by the White Knight. White Knight is a carrier jet, and, you know, jet engines on it, and the spaceship, too, is, you know, the vehicle, they call it, the whole, you know, he named it Unity, gets carried by the carrier up to 45,000 feet, and they drop it like a bomb, and you're inside of it, and this thing reignites. It's got this hybrid engine. It's not really a solid fuel rocket. Solid fuel rocket, you know, it ignites and you can't shut it off. This is solid fuel, but the difference is the oxygen is supplied separately, liquid oxygen. Where a solid fuel rocket, the oxygen and the fuel are mixed, usually a form of aluminum with oxygen, you know, as part of the solid fuel. And when those things ignite, that's it. They don't shut them off. You know, it's like a sparkler. So, but the hybrid system, you can throttle it, and you can actually shut it off. So we'll see. It'll drop from the carrier jet is called White Knight. It'll drop from that, or White Knight 2 is actually, you know, the second version of the carrier jet. It drops, and then will ignite. Got one engine, and it will take them straight up. The only thing is, I don't think they're going to make it to the Kármán line. I believe they're going to make it past 50 miles, which, according to the United States, which is NASA, and 50 miles, you're considered an astronaut. So they'll get their astronaut wings, all, you know, the whole crew. And definitely Jeff Bezos will. He'll get over the Kármán line. But this guy, Richard Branson, is going up in Virgin Galactic spacecraft. He's got a pilot and co-pilot. They've been up before. And he also has three other people going with him. One is Beth Moses. She went up in this vehicle one other time, too, as the first passenger. She'll be going up again. You also have the vice president of this company, as well as another guy. So these eight, but this flight they're gonna have six people. And if this all works out, he's gonna start taking paying customers starting next year in 2022. So this should be interesting. Next couple of weeks, two billionaires are going to make it to space. One of them will not make it above the Kármán line, and the other one will. But it looks like they both will get the astronaut wings. See, the other, you know, the other, there's a group in Switzerland that they've been around since 1905. And that this organization, they call it Federation Aeronautic, it's the Federation of Aeronautics. There's a French version for it, Federation Aeronautique Internationale. Been around since 1905, and they keep all kinds of records and everything in Switzerland. But as far as they're concerned, on an international level, you have to get above the 62-mile or Kármán line to qualify as an astronaut. But that doesn't hold true with the United States. Miles is the number. So it should be interesting. We'll be following this next Sunday. Richard Branson, and then on the 20th, Jeff Bezos. Any comments or questions? today, I guess not. Last year in the news, we talked about all these different vehicles that were going to Mars. We, of course, sent Perseverance with a helicopter launched on the Atlas V rocket, and then, of course, China sent their lander, which successfully landed a rover on Mars as well. They launched at the same time during the same month, and also the United Arab Emirates wanted to put a satellite in orbit around Mars, and they contracted with Japan to launch on their H-2A liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen vehicle from Japan, and they also successfully made it into orbit. There was also a fourth one that was supposed to go, and the name of it was called the Franklin, Roseland Franklin vehicle, another rover, and this was by the European Space Agency. It was supposed to launch at the same time last year, and it was supposed to land in February, just like our Perseverance rover did. But it didn't make the window because they were having trouble with their parachute, this 105-foot diameter parachute. You know, first there's a 40-foot parachute that comes out, and then a big one comes out after that. And each one has drogue parachutes that come out, so it's a series of parachutes that come out before it lands on Mars. And they had a lot of trouble with theirs, and they couldn't make it. They were not confident that it would open up properly when it got to Mars. Everything was ready to go. It's a solar powered rover, all kinds of instruments. I think 11 different instruments on board. They want to be able to detect life, and by the European Space Agency, and it was scheduled to actually launch on a Russian rocket. So I think that plan has changed. I don't think they're going to be going up on that Russian rocket anymore. I think they might use the new Ariane 6 rocket. I'm not sure how they're going to do it, if they're still going to contract with Russia or not. But anyway, they plan on launching late next year, September, because they finally got their parachute situation figured out. They did a smart thing. They went over to JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory at NASA, Pasadena, California, and they worked with them to try to straighten out their problem. And then just last week, they ran a test, a high altitude test. They sent this thing up a balloon all the way up to, maybe 20 miles high, and dropped this weight, which duplicates the weight of what the rover would be like as it was going through a Mars atmosphere. And sure enough, the parachute system worked, and successfully. I think they'll probably run another test. But as far as they're concerned, it's good to go. So that means by, by 23, they will have another rover.
WB2EAV.
On Mars, and WB2EAV. Go ahead.
Did you say that one is named after Rosalind Franklin?
Yes, that's true. They picked that name, I guess about 2.5 years ago. Before that, it was just the EXO, and what do they call it? The EXO rover from the European Space Agency back here.
I am very pleasantly surprised because I felt she always got a raw deal. She was working with Watson and Crick on what turned out to be DNA, but she got sick with cancer and died. And then they kind of forgot about her, but some people are saying she really was the brains in the outfit.
Oh, Okay. Yeah, I remember reading about it. I probably talked about it on the net. I think Dr. conversation when she was first picked a couple of years ago. But, I at that time, I never heard of it until they picked her. And now a lot more people are going to know about it, especially when this thing launches and hopefully it lands on Mars properly. Thank you. Yeah, I came across a picture of a parachute. It is a massive parachute. They show it on the ground with some guy standing there, and you can see the relative size of this thing. And it's got a lot of Kevlar in it. They noticed that one part of it was strained a little bit, so they'll probably strengthen that up. You know, everything has to go just right when they come through the Mars atmosphere. They come through at 13,000 miles an hour. And they have a heat shield, and eventually the heat shield separates, and then they have instruments that can see the ground. They know how, radar and stuff, and they LIDAR, and they know how high they are above the ground, and eventually that separates, and it's got some rocket motors on board that will slow it down and land. I believe this one is going to be on top of the lander and then ride down a ramp. I'll have to check. But, hopefully the Rosalind Franklin works good. And let's see, we'll move on. And nobody has any more comments. This is WS2N. Getting a little jealous. They plan on sending their own astronauts up probably by 2028. I guess that will be delayed probably till 2030. But their own astronauts on their own vehicle. Other countries are getting involved. India now has their space program. They plan on sending a crew of three people up probably in the same time frame, 2030, maybe 2032. I think the European Space Agency wants to beat that. And they'll launch on the Ariane 6. We have, right now, we have the Ariane 5 that we depend on. And now the Ariane 6 is in development. They haven't launched it yet, but probably within, maybe by the end of this year or early next year, they'll have that thing going. Ariane 5, very reliable. It launched probably about 80 different flights. And NASA has contracted with them to launch the James Webb Space Telescope in this October. This $10 billion thing that's been under construction for 10 or 11 years now is ready to go. They're all, packing it up and eventually shipping it to French Guiana, where it's going to be launched from, from South America. And hopefully that goes well, because the Hubble Space Telescope is having problems. Hopefully, they think they can turn that around. I talked about that last week. They have computer problems. There was a backup computer. And they think they're going to resolve that. But in case they don't, they have the James Webb Space Telescope, which has got like a 21-foot mirror. Hubble has an 8-foot mirror. So it's a big difference. They both can see in infrared, but James Webb goes even more into the infrared than Hubble could. Hubble did a little bit. Not like this thing. This thing will be able to scan through any kind of clouds that are obscuring stars or galaxies because of the infrared capability. And hopefully that thing gets up there okay. It's as big as a tennis court. It's going to unfold like an origami setup. You know, the mirror itself has got different segments. It's got three pieces that have to unfold to align itself. It's got a big tennis court size sun reflector that has to open up properly. It's got five layers to it, each one not touching one another. It's got solar panels. It's got a gyro system that's probably as big as a dollar bill. Not even, a cash dollar, you know. It's a small round thing, and then that's the, of course, communication. And it's going to be out a million miles away from Earth, so we'll never be able to service this thing once it gets where it's going. Which should be interesting. It's got like 87 different pyrotechnic devices that have to explode to unfold everything. And if one of them doesn't work, that could be the end of the mission. And it's not gonna be any way to service it 1 million miles away. It's four times the distance of the moon. And, they call it the L2 location. So it doesn't really orbit Earth, kind of like orbits the sun. It follows the Earth and all the way around the orbit of the sun. So it'll be looking out, and it's supposed to be, I think 100 times better than Hubble. We'll see how it does. Let me drop it. Okay, I wanted to go over this. I don't know, it might be a little too complicated, but this is not really a launch. It's a study of the ionosphere. And what this was they wanted to, there's satellites already in space called ICON, which studies the ionosphere. And NASA wants to launch two suborbital flights. So, it's not an orbital launch that they want to do. It's two suborbital flights from Wallops Island to study the ionosphere. They want to study, they call it a ionosphere current. Electricity that's flowing in the ionosphere, and they're trying to figure out its properties. They know it's there, but for years, decades, they couldn't figure out what was causing it. So they realized that, you needed three things to have a generator. And of course, this goes back, over 100 years. You needed something that was, capable of carrying electricity. So if you took a copper plate and spun it between a magnet, of course you need a magnet. And then if you had the movement, you have those three things: movement, copper plate that's moving, and two stationary magnets, or anything magnetic will set up a current on that plate. And they know now that that's what's happening with the ionosphere. The reason I got interested in this is because of ham radio. And they plan on launching these two rockets, which will, usually when they do this, they let smoke out of the rocket. They can figure out which way the winds are blowing when it goes up. They're using some kind of a barometric sensor in the rocket itself to tell what the pressure is going to be on one side compared to the other. And the reason that they're doing all this, they want to see the movement of the atmosphere at that elevation, you know, in the ionosphere. And they figured out that the ionosphere was conductive, so that would be like the copper plate. And then they realized that, you know, they had that magnetic field, because the Earth is one big magnetic field, so they had that. But what they didn't have was movement. They wanted to prove some kind of movement that was going on at that level. And what they realized is that when the sun is directly overhead, it's heating the ground, and the ground air is moving straight up, and eventually it gets up pretty high and actually starts moving the little electrons that are in the ionosphere. And this movement was coming in waves. It would heat up, and then essentially you got waves up at that altitude. They had all the three ingredients. They had the movement. That's what they were looking for. They had the conductive field, which was the ions. And the reason they had the ions was because the sun is, we know that the sun is hitting the atmosphere, the rarefied air that's up there, and it's separating, creating ions. So we had a conductive field, and then we had, the three parts of the generator: the conductive field, the magnetic field from the Earth, from the Earth's poles. And this final experiment would prove out the movement, this wave, this oscillating wave that's actually coming up from the ground, from the air, rising. And to prove that, to show it in depth, to study it, they're going to launch these two rockets. One rocket will launch in, 15 minutes later, the other rocket will launch all from Wallops Island, Virginia. And one will be studying the ionosphere, while the other one is transmitting back information. They're going to work together. And then there's a third satellite called ICON that's also already in orbit. I think that's around 400 miles in altitude. And they're going to time these launches when it's, 12 o'clock over the launch pad. And also they're going to have the ICON satellite, which normally studies the ionosphere, also looking at this at the same time. So I don't know, I was reading about it. It looked really, really interesting. Some of these sounding rockets, it's hard to figure out what they're really doing. But in this case, NASA laid it out pretty good when I was reading it. Any comments or questions? This is WS2M. Just read this a couple of days ago, but I thought I'd talk about it because I believe they're going to launch these sounding rockets very, very soon. So if it's in the news and they do that, it'll be old news by the time we talk about it. So I had to bring that up. One other last thing I wanted to talk about has nothing to do with the United States. It's China. If you follow the internet, you know that China now has their own space station. Right now it's one big long module. I think it's around 55 feet long, 14 feet in diameter. It's got two docking ports on it, one that you could dock a crew to it, and the other one you could dock a cargo vehicle to it. So, right now you now have a crew up there, three, and you have the capability of resupplying food and everything that they need up there. So now they need to outfit this thing get it ready to do that. They did an EVA last week as well. So two of the three went outside. And they even have a smaller robotic arm out there to attach one of the astronauts to. to it, which they did. So it's like 30 feet long. Our Canada Ross 2 is 57 feet long. But they have one, and they plan on eventually using that robotic arm to build the space station bigger. And they plan on sending up two more modules, similar to the one that just went up, you know, roughly 50 feet long. Each one's 14 feet in diameter. And they plan on setting it up like a giant T. So that will eventually give them more room, and maybe possibly eventually more astronauts if they do that. And they have the capability of also adding three more modules in the far distant future. That I don't think it's funded for that. But anyway, we have these China astronauts, they're called Takanauts, and they did their first EVA. It's actually their second EVA ever, I think, I don't know, many years ago during the first space station that they had. It didn't last long. They did an EVA to see if they could, and now they improved on their suits. Boy, the suits sure do look a lot like our suits. I don't know if they have a safer system on board. That would be in case you broke loose from the space station, you'd be able to use nitrogen jets to fly yourself back. I don't know if they have that. They'll look and find out if they do. Knowing China, they probably have it. Any other comments or questions? Okay. I don't really have anything else here. I did read about the Dugo 1 radar system. Back in the 70s and 80s,
that time,
close to 40 meters, and you could hear the woodpecker noise, you know. And, you know, every time the Russians had that on, they were looking for missiles coming over the horizon. And this thing was built in the Ukraine, in the area where Chernobyl is. I think they abandoned this thing 100%. But they showed pictures of it the other day. I should have sent it to Roy. Print on the on his website, but I didn't. Massive. I mean, this goes on like a couple of miles in length, and hundreds of feet high. And then this was their radar system. And from what I understand, they had a couple more similar to it. But I mean, it sounds like real overkill. And it used to be really annoying on 40 meters. And it made it almost impossible to work phone. Thankfully, I'm a big CW fan, so I really didn't have a problem. Any other questions or comments for Annette? This is WS2M. Nothing heard. I'll turn it back to you, Roy. Say, happy 4th of July to everybody. It's been relatively quiet here. And we'll be on the club information net tomorrow night at 8:30 on these repeaters. Back to you, Roy, AC2GS, WS2N.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report and for all the things that you do. I want to thank everyone for participating tonight. Please come back next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we'll try and do it all over again. Have a safe and enjoyable remainder of the 4th of July weekend. Once again, a little reminder, if you want to reach me, my email address can be mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. The link page is available. I have included some interesting material on WWVB. There's a report about its configuration lately. It usually has two transmitters for a total of about 70 kilowatts. It's been operating in half-power mode for over at least a year, so that's an interesting thing. And there's some interesting other material, so there's links available for that. there's a link available with a story.